Good morning. My name is Melissa Carter. Thank you for being with me again this morning for She Persisted. I think that I am a unique individual. I think everybody's a unique individual, but the reason I think I'm particularly unique is that I must be the only woman on the planet that doesn't like wine. Yes, I said it. I don't have a taste for wine. Any wine bottles that are in my home are for guests or for gifts when I go out. I just don't like it. But I admit I'm one of the few women who feels that way. I usually, when I'm out, I get a good stiff drink. I'm a liquor girl. Pardon the pun. But most of my girlfriends are huge wine drinkers. And I'm assuming you are a huge wine drinker too. And one of the problems with drinking as you get older is that you feel the effects of the drinking without having to drink very much. Do you notice that? I know for me that I have to choose when I drink so that I can recover from it in an ample amount of time. I've shared that I'm a mother, so I have to figure out when I have my son, because, you know, I share custody with his other mother, when I have my son, when I might have an event, when I might have, you know, somewhere I need to be where I don't feel funky. I mean, it's almost like this puzzle piece, this equation that I have to put together to give myself the freedom to drink. On the nights, it's like, oh, yeah, I can do it because I got time in the morning to feel better. Ridiculous, right? Well, if you have the same problem, there's a new device that has been invented that might help you out. Now, I'm not endorsing this because I don't drink wine, but it's for wine connoisseurs specifically. A company out of Texas is called Pure Wine. It's a startup company, and their product is called The Wand. And if I could describe The Wand, it kind of looks like fly swatter. That is such a modern reference. Don't you agree? It's the first thing that came to mind. Who the hell has a fly swatter now? I did as a kid. And my mother, to go off on a tangent for a second, she would actually use that fly swatter to whip me. So The Wand, it looks like a small fly swatter, and you put it in your wine and you stir it. The fly swatter part has a filter on it, and you stir it in your wine for 3 minutes. Now, that's a long time, about the length of a song. However, it is said to take away 95% of the toxins that cause you to have a hangover. There are, of course, are skeptics who say this is ridiculous. There's no way that can work. But tests are showing that The Wand is actually living up to what it says it can do. So I'm letting you know, you can be your own citizen scientist and try it out for yourself, because I don't drink wine. And so I'm not going to use it, especially since it looks like the fly swatter I got whipped with. It's going to cause me some flashbacks. The Wand. Pure Wine is the name of the company. Another technological advancement I want to share with you is something that you may have heard about already, but you haven't tried. And if you have tried, you are on the cutting edge. Bitcoin is a sample of what's called cryptocurrency, and that is the future of trading goods and services, according to experts. So if you're not on board with cryptocurrency, I'm a full proponent that women need to be self-sufficient. So you need to know about this technology so that you can make more money off of it now compared to if you waited too late to where everybody else is on board. And that is why I'm bringing on our next guest. His name is Kirill Ravensong. He is the chief strategist at Heronomics Inc. and BitShares, and he joins us today to talk about this new technology. Kirill, I thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And my first question is, you know, I think that a lot of people are familiar with Bitcoin. And, you know, for instance, and they see that word and they understand that it's something of the future. However, I think a lot of people aren't confident in investing in it because they honestly don't know about it. So could you just dumb it down in the beginning to let people know exactly what Bitcoin is?
Sure. So when we're talking about, first of all, it's a pleasure to be on the show. And I really want to applaud you in particular on taking the time to actually dig in deep and find out about something that clearly has a lot of impact. So,
well, you know,
I'm
going to interrupt you for a second, because I think that I want to comment on that, because I never wanted to be a hypocrite. So I was the person who, when I was the kid, you know, my parents were pretty, they tried their best to be up to date on a lot of things. I came from parents that were much older than me, so I was the oops baby. You know, actually. And so, but they were very good about staying up to date on technology, on things that were going on. But I also, when they were ignorant to certain things, I remember telling myself, I never want to be of an age in which I close the door on learning new things. And so I appreciate you coming in because I'm going to fulfill that promise to myself, because here I am in midlife and I'm in the position where I could easily say, I don't want to, you know, oh, I'm too old for that. I don't want to do this. And I just think that that is going to end up, as you may explain, cost me money if I do that.
Yeah. See, this is so this is the key element. When I was a kid growing up, I had access to also my grandparents as well as my parents. And in many ways, my grandparents, particularly on my mother's side, really took the time to explain to me how the world works, particularly financially on the macro and on the society-wide scale. This was very important to them. So whenever we talk about cryptocurrency, remember, we're talking in the context of business as usual. We're talking about the financial markets of today. We're talking about money as it is today. And there's so much ignorance about our current monetary system that that's actually the greater difficulty in talking about cryptocurrency. Because it's only in the compare and contrast do you actually see how interesting and how powerful the tool cryptocurrency could be.
Well, and I think that I just, like I said, there's almost an ego, there's an ego playing in people where they also want to act like they know more than they do. And I look, I'm explaining to listeners, I'm coming on this perception, and Kirill and I will talk, if he doesn't mind, later on about women and investing. But I just want, my goal with this show is to help women become self-sufficient, because I think there's a lot of women that are not self-sufficient. And I do not think that family members or partners or whatever is an investment, a financial investment. I think that money should be something that you have for yourself, regardless of your situation. That's my personal stance. So anyway, that's one of the reasons I want you to tell us about cryptocurrency, why we should be involved in it more than we are.
So the first level of why people need to be involved in cryptocurrency is that this is the next thing. There's no getting around it. It's going to be a game changer when it gets even mild adoption from the larger public. Right now, you're looking at only about 1% of the marketplace is currently really using it. Now, you have to also remember that when you're talking about global sales and global participation in the economy, there are whole billions of people who are not currently participating in it, who soon will. And they're going to be participating using the technological and information technology advances that have come with the internet. And the likelihood that they will be using cryptocurrency, which is a virtual currency, or one of the other digital currencies, which most of our money is 100%. So that's a wild game changer in literally how many people are going to be participating in our global economy.
I have always been a geek. My brother's a computer programmer, so we've always prided ourselves on trying to be on the cutting edge of technology rather than on the tail end. And I remember just as something as simple as online shopping is something we were doing long before anybody felt comfortable doing it themselves. And so it's like you said, I mean, I assume that this is the same type of attitude where people, they're just slow to change. However, like you said, when you think about the banks, most of us do not do any banking in a brick and mortar, and we don't write checks anymore. We do everything online anyway. So what's the difference?
Okay, so the difference is that we have, by and large, switched to a cashless digital economy. That's just standard as is. That's the first thing to kind of recognize, that most people are already using digital currency. The real question is who controls it and to what end. That there's a phenomenal difference between the two. And look, in the past, when you were getting an education in finances, you were usually learning about how money works, about how interest, compound interest in your savings accounts can work. You were learning about the power of bonds, the power of stocks. Those options that our grandparents had access to, they don't exist anymore. The financial institutions are regularly not just accused of, but actually proven to be guilty of fraud in the billions plus. That's a regular occurrence. And yet there seems to be no real consequence to that. Mm-hmm. So you have to take it in this context of what was previously true about financial intelligence is completely untrue now. You need a completely different way of looking at things that's much more like traditional economy, traditional products, network effects in your community or people that you know, peer-to-peer relationships. That's where cryptocurrency actually shines very brightly, that it allows for peer-to-peer commerce without intervention of third parties like banks or governments, so that it's directly the result of a value exchange in a relationship.
Now, Kirill, so we're talking to Kirill Ravensong. Now, Kirill, let's take, for instance, let's walk through somebody through what their life may look like with cryptocurrency. How would today, if somebody needs to invest in it, what should they do and how would they use it?
So for right now, what I would say is the first way that we get involved in cryptocurrency is by buying Bitcoin. That's the typical entry. And you should treat it like gold. You should treat it like a commodity that will go up in value, but that you're not necessarily going to spend or trade in any particular degree.
And again, I apologize for being so elementary in my questions, but how would someone who has probably never invested, because even as you say, treat it like gold, I think there's a lot of people that just have not done any investing. So if somebody wanted to invest in Bitcoin, what would the average person who's just hearing about this for the first time, how should they invest in it or what avenues?
So if we're getting really at the basic level, I guess the way you have to look at it is you have to look at things in the short term, midterm, and long term. So the beauty of Bitcoin as an asset is that if you look at just 2 years ago, it was valued at $600 per bit share. Now it's about 4,000 plus, right? Almost $5,000 per bit share. That's just 2 years. I don't know that you're going to find very many things on the market aside from maybe derivatives, and that's a whole other bag of worms. But there are not that many assets that perform that well. So that's one way to look at it. Like you're kind of just storing up for the future. You know, you're putting aside, you know, maybe it's like you can squirrel away $100 a month that were going towards things that you didn't really need. Maybe you can skip one of those cups of coffee or that triple frappuccino, or, you know, you find little ways to cut out frivolous expenses and then you just buy a commodity that you believe will go up in value, like gold, like silver, or like cryptocurrency, like Bitcoin.
More with our conversation about cryptocurrency coming up here on She Persisted on the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Melissa Carter.
Whether you're listening to me, Mark Levine, each Monday and Wednesday,
or me, Leslie Marshall, each Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday,
you can hear us 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.
Here's a sample of what you'll hear.
I recognize we're not going to ban all guns in America, at least no time in the next decade. But how about banning guns that can shoot across two football fields that are automatic or are semi-automatic can be converted easily to an automatic weapon? You heard the sounds. You saw the video. Every little pop, someone's dead or wounded or shot or injured. Yeah, I realize that machine guns are banned in America. But what do we hear from that hotel window? Sure sounded like a machine gun, like an automatic weapon. And we have to learn how we got that weapon. And frankly, the person who sold them that weapon should get lifetime imprisonment, at least. Maybe if we had lifetime imprisonment for gun sellers, maybe they would think twice. In Virginia, where I'm a delegate in the Virginia House of Delegates, it is perfectly legal to sell semi-automatic weapons with massive ammunition clips. You can sell them to members of the ISIS terrorist group. You can also sell them to someone with a long history of domestic violence. How do you do it? Well, you don't do it in a gun store. That's prohibited by federal law. You just do it in the alleyway behind the gun store. You meet them on the internet. All you do is say, hey, I want to sell a gun to a complete stranger, no question asked. And the complete stranger walks up and says, great. He's thinking to himself, I want to murder hundreds of Americans. How do I do it? I want to buy a gun, no questions asked. Meet me behind the gun store. And every year, Republicans try to pass bills to make it easier for criminals to get guns, to make it easier for insane people to get guns, to make it easier for terrorists to get guns, and not just any guns, powerful guns. Background checks bills like the ones that I've put forward to ban sales to terrorists or to ban sales over the internet to complete strangers stopped in subcommittee. Meanwhile, Republicans They put forward bills to make guns more accessible. Let's bring guns into an emergency shelter. That was one of those bills that I voted on. I voted no. This very year, we hear lots of talk that it's not the right time to talk about guns, that we shouldn't politicize them. It's not just not the right time, but then it's never the right time. Republicans said for a long time, there's no need to talk about climate change. It's in the distant past. Even if global warming exists and even humans are causing it, it won't happen in my lifetime. Just put it off. Well, now this year, with hurricane after hurricane killing hundreds of Americans and no power in Puerto Rico. Wow, the poor people in Puerto Rico. Suffering there, millions of people without power and losing their homes and many of their lives. Now maybe they'll talk about climate change, or is that too soon, Republicans? How many mass murders do we have until we talk about gun laws? What is this idea that politicians who are elected to solve problems should just do nothing as the problems get worse and worse and worse? Is our compassion for the victims supposed to outweigh our intense desire that there be no more victims? Doesn't that mean that the victims died in vain if we do nothing to prevent future violence? To ask the question is to answer it. We don't think about it, but I have a license plate on my car. I registered my car. If I kill someone with my car, it's easy to find me. And I have to be careful when someone drives my car because, hey, it's my car. Why wouldn't we do that with guns? Cars actually have a purpose other than killing things. They take us from place to place. They may accidentally kill someone, but most car accidents are just that, accidents. Most gun deaths are purposeful. And even most accidents are you know, the wrong person handling the gun. I think it's a very basic thing, and I don't know why people fear it. You know, people are like, oh no, if the government knows where our guns are, they're going to take it away. Well, they know where our cars are, and I haven't seen any, you know, mass taking away of cars. Again, that's Mark Levine every Monday and Wednesday.
And Leslie Marshall each Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday.
3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.
Hey, Progressive Voices listeners. I'm Rebecca Vallis, host of Off Kilter, here on the Progressive Voices Network. With the new Supreme Court term underway, this week I spoke with Ian Millhiser, justice editor at Think Progress, to get a rundown on the big cases this term and what to watch. Let's take a listen.
This is a huge deal because gerrymandering has gotten so sophisticated. Like, it's easy to draw a map that will lock your party in for, like, the next election and maybe the election after that. But it's gotten so sophisticated now that people can draw maps that lock parties in for five elections in a row. And the thing about locking yourself in for five elections in a row is after five elections, you have another redistricting cycle. So you can keep rinse washing, repeating this. And if this Wisconsin gerrymander is not struck down, what it means is that the Republican Party is likely to control the assembly forever. And so, you know, the good news for, like, people who actually like democracy is I think we're going to get Kennedy. I mean, Kennedy can be a little hard to read, but he seemed visibly angered at one point at that one of the pro-gerrymandering attorneys wasn't answering his questions. He didn't ask any questions at all of Paul Smith, the voting rights attorney. And, you know, that's a good sign that, like, he was just sort of rolling along with what Paul was saying. So I am optimistic. I think that if the good guys do win, it's a 5-4. But I think that it is more likely than not that the courts are going to say, okay, this is too far. You know, at the very least, it can't be the case that the party that won the 2010 elections gets to rule their state forever.
And this is a Wisconsin case, but it potentially has huge implications nationally,
right,
and for elections for decades to come.
Right. Because, I mean, if the Wisconsin – I mean, you've got a number of states, you know, where gerrymandering is the worst tends to be in, you know, in closely divided states like Wisconsin. And so you've got a number of states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Florida, that are closely divided states. I mean, I was chatting with a buddy of mine yesterday who's one of Governor McAuliffe's appointees in Virginia, and he was telling me, like, they think it is impossible for them to win the Virginia State House in this upcoming election in Virginia. They think they can hold the governorship. They think it is impossible because Virginia is so gerrymandered. And so in a lot of these states, not only do you suddenly have the chance of having a democracy in those states again, but you could also potentially unravel a lot of congressional gerrymanders in these states.
Thanks for listening. For more Off Kilter, find us on the Progressive Voices Network and as a podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at Off Kilter Show and at Facebook.com/Off Kilter Show.
Ever think about what ideas can do? Well, then you realize the size of the thinker does not determine or limit the size of the idea. That is what my children's book is all about. It's called Whale of an Idea, and if you need a gift for a baby shower or a party, I would love for you to consider it. Whale of an Idea, available now online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Welcome back. I'm Melissa Carter. More of our conversation about cryptocurrency with Kareel Ravensong here on She Persisted. One of the things I would love to tell my sisters out there is that you have to be financially sustainable as an individual. So you cannot rely on other people anymore to provide for you. You should have at 18 or 22 decided that you didn't want your parents to provide for you anymore, at least in theory, at least in your mind. And then I am a huge advocate of your husband is not your financial investment. So Kareel, tell us a little bit about your background. And then I'm curious about your experiences with women in that background, if you've had any when it comes to finance.
Yeah. I mean, my primary mentors in business have actually been women.
That's fantastic. I'm so glad you said that.
So, you know, it's kind of a funny thing. I've always been particularly sensitive. You know, I'm very ferocious combatively. I love martial art and meditation. I've always been kind of a brawler and trying to channel my aggression in useful ways. And I have lots of brothers in arms that I, you know, dearly love and love working with. And yet, because I'm very sensitive, I'm just more attuned to, let's just say, a broader range of information that over the years I notice many of the women I know take for granted that that's just their way of perceiving. Mm-hmm. And when it came for me to succeed in business, you know, I had to kind of find what's my lane. And it just happened to be with female business partners and mentors. A lot of what I do is communication-based. I listen to people. I listen to my marketplace. I listen to what people really, really need, like underneath the surface requests. I identify those needs and I meet those needs.
So what are some of the challenges that you've seen, especially with female clients, and maybe some of the mistakes that some of your colleagues and mentors have shared with you on their journey?
Yeah, I mean, one of the main things is, you know, sometimes gets called like toxic masculinity or, you know, ego. There's this study of investments in small communities that I found fascinating. This was a study in Southeast Asia, and it's been duplicated and is kind of a trend. And these groups found that when they gave influxes of cash to men, you know, overall, it's not 100%, but overall, you notice a tendency for these men to invest those surplus funds that were above and beyond into alcohol and prostitution. Whereas when you invested in women, similar amounts, they tended to invest in food for their children and education as well. So you start to notice that there are some biological tendencies in very undeveloped countries. But then when you come to the developed West, even though men and women do tend to average out in a lot of ways socially and intellectually, which gives them a comparatively capacity-wise and level playing field in the marketplace, you still find that there are a lot of bizarre decisions that are very masculine in their impetus that you know that if they were exposed to more feminine eyes would be completely not allowed anymore.
I think that we fracture ourselves as a society in order just to obtain our identity and make sure that we rise above and everybody's on a level playing field. But at some point, and even in the gender war, quote unquote, we're all a big puzzle. And the puzzle pieces are supposed to fit together even though they're different. And even if one puzzle piece is missing, the whole thing is ruined. So I do agree that it's not supposed to be an all-female, you know, driven world. It should be a balanced with everybody world, like you said, to where masculine and feminine decisions are mixed in together. Is it a case where with women they shouldn't feel self-conscious because maybe if they're turned off by investing because they find it to be a very male thing, is there a different way for women to be able to look at it and feel comfortable with it?
Yes, there's no reason to feel uncomfortable now. Actually, this is a time where I think the main thing that is occurring now that's actually very encouraging for women getting into investing is that we're in a new normal. And that means that no one's an expert anymore. I'm not an expert in cryptocurrency. I happen to be in it and spending a lot of time utilizing it and looking at how it works. But because it's so new, even the best of us still have to say at the end of the day, well, we don't know, because there's so much in flux. It really does depend on what the public does, on what individuals say is important to them. And if you think about investing less so much as securing your future as creating the foundation upon which future generations arrive into, then you can look at investment as like a civic duty. It's your responsibility to make sure that your children, your grandchildren have the nut of wealth necessary to perpetuate without any financial woes. And it's actually possible now, I believe, for the first time, maybe in hundreds of years, for that type of wealth to be accumulated by basically ordinary people.
So we're talking to Kirill Ravensong and about cryptocurrency. So if somebody heard this and thought, okay, you know, okay, I got it. I'm going to do this. I'm going to invest in it. What is the minimum amount that you think that they need in order to start the process?
Well, I mean, if you were to put in just $100 or $200 and you could do that every month for the next 12 months, and put it into Bitcoin, and then from Bitcoin, maybe you wanted to branch out and do a few different currencies, that would be kind of the smart play. Small amounts, very modest, and just watch what it does. Buy it to hold on to it, and just watch it. Does it grow in value? If so, how fast? What do you learn about it? Are there places where you can spend it? All of it becomes more interesting when you have even just like a couple of $100 into it.
We talked earlier about just online shopping and people being freaked out by that because they didn't want to put a credit card online because they didn't think it was safe. How about spend a moment discussing the safety of all this? I think people always, when they're confused or where they don't want to change their routine, fear is kind of the basis for them to talk themselves out of it.
Yeah.
People, I'm sure, are thinking, well, it's not safe. How can I make sure that that $100 and $200 a month that I'm investing is in a secure place? How would you address that?
Well, there are two factors. So when we're talking about the security of the investment, the more secure an investment, typically the less the return on that investment. So if you're looking at something like cryptocurrency, it's highly volatile. You're looking at Ethereum and Bitcoin, which have just soared in value, but it's because there's a lot of risk and a lot of utility. So these things have value in and of themselves, and that takes a little learning curve to discern what the value is in these tools. But the second thing is like, well, that's part of investing. If you're investing for the longer term, over the next 5, 10, 20 years, then volatility in the short term is not so problematic. Remember, those $100 or $200 invested 2 years ago would have given you enormous returns now. So the big thing that I'm personally kind of taking it upon myself to do is to make sure that, one, people kind of recognize the value of cryptocurrency itself, and then look for those opportunities for undervalued, highly developed assets like BitShares, for example, that are assets that I believe will soar in value. So those, just those, that $100, that $200 that you can put aside into it, my belief is that it will give you way bigger returns than just about anything else you could put money into.
We'll have more after this break on She Persisted. I'm Melissa Carter.
Hello, Progressive Voices TuneIn listeners. I'm Casey Hobbs.
And I'm Shane Mason, and we're the hosts of Nurse Talk Radio.
Here's what we're talking about this week.
I happened to read my hometown newspaper that said that people were expected to drive from literally hundreds of miles away and that they were expecting thousands of people to come to this Wise County Fairgrounds to get free care. And when I got there, I saw people who could have been people I grew up with, could have been relatives of mine, could have been me. People were lined up by the hundreds, waiting in these long lines that I noticed led to barns and animal stalls where they were being treated. by doctors and nurses and dentists who were volunteering their time. And I knew the moment I walked through the fairground gates that I was at least partly responsible for that scene, because I was working to perpetuate a very broken, very dysfunctional healthcare system that made it impossible for so many people, including those people who were there, to get care in a proper setting and care that they could afford. So I, soon after that, I turned in my resignation and started a new life. And what I came to obviously realize was that that's what I was being paid to do in my corporate job, working for these health insurance companies. I was paid to present a world that wasn't real and to make people believe things that weren't true. Often it was various things that we did to essentially spread propaganda about how the health insurance system really works, or to scare people away from any alternatives to the multi-payer system that we have. So I really had an epiphany.
I'm so glad that you had the courage to take that look. And then after taking that honest look, then making the leap to do something completely different.
People need to be more involved in making positive change happen and how the health insurance system really affects them.
Check out our show at nursetalksite.com and listen every Saturday and Sunday right here on Progressive Voices.
Whether you are in or out of town on New Year's Day, I invite you to watch the Rose Bowl Parade on January 1st. The reason? I have the honor of riding on the Donate Life Float thanks to my sponsor, Atlantis Piedmont Healthcare. I'm a kidney transplant recipient 15 years this year, and it is a joy to be able to be in the parade that I've watched since I was a kid. Find out more and become an organ donor at DonateLifeFloat.org. That's DonateLifeFloat.org. Now back with financial expert Kirill Ravensong on She Persisted on the Progressive Voices Network. I started the conversation by talking about Bitcoin because that's what I had personally seen in the news the most. But how much cryptocurrency is out there? How many different choices do people have?
Oh, goodness. I think there are almost 1,000 different coins right now. There'll probably be more before the dust sort of settles. Right now, the big question is which currencies are going to integrate well with the existing government banking systems. So, for example, Bitcoin is kind of like the problem child. It's like the older sibling that busts out and says, I'm here, and goes out and kicks ass in the marketplace. It gets a lot of scrutiny, it gets a lot of love, a lot of hate. But it is kind of the first exemplar of the underlying blockchain technology to cut away the need for government and the need for banking just for a value exchange. It doesn't mean that you don't need government for other things, you don't need banking for other things, but you don't need anyone to say that this is okay if there's a trust protocol built in that can withstand the test of time.
If people are investing, how long do you think it's going to take? I mean, again, you've expressed you're not the expert and your word is not going to be the law, but in your mind, in your professional opinion, what do you think, how much time is going to go by before cryptocurrency actually is a lot of, or the majority of how we exchange goods?
I think in the next 3 years, you'll see a surge for your early adopters. So the next 3 years, for those who are smart and really take the advice and take the plunge and put in modest amounts, in about 3 years, you're going to see their financial life different, completely different. In terms of mass adoption, I would say at least another 10 years, maybe more.
Hmm. Kirill, one last question I've got for you. Is there any particular advice that you have for women when it comes to investing, whether they're in their 20s or whether they're in their 50s or even older?
Yeah, I mean, have fun, actually. Like, really, really embrace that you can learn the moment you make the decision that you need to. And, you know, we hear a lot of lip service about the pay gap between men and women. And by and large, it's really a distraction. Even the wealth gap between the top 1% and the rest of us, even that is nowhere near the knowledge gap. So the biggest investment that you can make, first and foremost, is in yourself in the form of your education. And the moment you make the decision to educate yourself about your finances, I assure you, anyone, it's not an issue of intelligence. It's an issue of being able to take in information being able to ask people you know or experts for guidance and advice, making decisions based on that advice, taking responsibility, and then really just putting little bits amount of money into investments and seeing how it goes over 1 year, 2 years, 10 years, and beyond.
Kirill Ravensong, is there anything else that we didn't cover that you'd like to express?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely look at BitShares as a platform, and mainly because it's very network-driven. Most of the architecture is the internet itself, and blockchain technology just kind of runs on it. So I would look at BitShares, which is bitshares.org, BitShares.org. Would look up there. And I would say that one of the things that I think people need to get comfortable with is this idea of revolution as normal, as like homeostasis in the body politic. So it can be very scary during times of change, but if you recognize that you are in a time of change, then you can see it as the opportunity. Maybe it took the founding fathers to establish our independence, but it will take all of us together to maintain it. And now's the time for people to actually get excited, to have their passions renewed, and to not accept anything less than total financial freedom.
Is there any way that people can find out more about you, or if they want to reach out to you, is that an option?
Sure. I make my email available. That's the best way to kind of pop a comment in. And that's my name, KirillRavensong@gmail.com.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. We really appreciate it. That was very educational, and I'm going to go start investing, I promise.
Rock on.
You are so excited to get your package, but it gets sent to the wrong address. No big deal unless you're shipping this. Coming up in my can of crazy, what a Pennsylvania man got in trouble for. Here on She Persisted on the Progressive Voices Network.
Hey, Progressive Voices listeners, I'm Rebecca Vallis, host of Off Kilter, here on the Progressive Voices Network. With the new Supreme Court term underway, this week I spoke with Ian Millhiser, justice editor at Think Progress, to get a rundown on the big cases this term and what to watch. Let's take a listen.
This is a huge deal because gerrymandering has gotten so sophisticated. Like, it's easy to draw a map that will lock your party in for like the next election and maybe the election after that. But it's gotten so sophisticated now that people can draw maps that lock parties in for five elections in a row. And the thing about locking yourself in for five elections in a row is after five elections, you have another redistricting cycle. So you can keep rinse washing, repeating this. And if this Wisconsin gerrymander is not struck down, what it means is that the Republican Party is likely to control the assembly forever. And so, you know, the good news for like people who actually like democracy is I think we're going to get Kennedy. I mean, Kennedy can be a little hard to read, but he seemed visibly angered at one point at that one of the pro-gerrymandering attorneys wasn't answering his questions. He didn't ask any questions at all of Paul Smith, the voting rights attorney. And, you know, that's a good sign that like he was just sort of rolling along with what Paul was saying. So I am optimistic. I think that if the good guys do win, it's a 5-4. But I think that it is more likely than not that the courts are going to say, OK, this is too far. You know, at the very least, it can't be the case that the party that won the 2010 elections gets to rule their state forever.
And this is a Wisconsin case, but it potentially has huge implications nationally,
right,
and for elections for decades to come.
Right. Because, I mean, if the Wisconsin – I mean, you've got a number of states, you know, where gerrymandering is the worst tends to be in, you know, in closely divided states like Wisconsin. And so you've got a number of states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Florida, that are closely divided states. I mean, I was chatting with a buddy of mine yesterday who's one of Governor McAuliffe's appointees in Virginia, and he was telling me like they think it is impossible for them to win the Virginia State House in this upcoming election in Virginia. They think they can hold the governorship. They think it is impossible because Virginia is so gerrymandered. And so in a lot of these states, not only do you suddenly have the chance of having a democracy in those states again, but you could also potentially unravel a lot of congressional gerrymanders in these states.
Thanks for listening. For more Off Kilter, find us on the Progressive Voices Network and as a podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at Off Kilter Show and at Facebook.com/Off Kilter Show.
The number one fear of Americans is public speaking, and most programs to, quote, cure that fear require an entire weekend and lots of money. You can do my quick online course called Speak Your Spirit in the privacy of your own home for only $50. SpeakYourSpirit.com and start sharing what you want to say. SpeakYourSpirit.com. Today's entry comes from Pennsylvania, where some college kids ordered fake IDs from China. Don't you wish you had the internet back in the day instead of your little cut paste trying to make your own fake ID? Not that you would do that. But a guy named Dean is the one who made the order and had the shipment of fake IDs sent to his campus address. What Dean didn't realize or didn't pay attention to is the fact that he shared the same name as someone else on campus, someone who happened to be in the main office. Yeah. Those fake IDs were sent to the administrator, who opened the box and found the realistic looking IDs complete with the students' real names. Police quote, "You can't make this stuff up." So congratulations to Dean and his buddies, because your little scheme made it into my can of crazy. More She Persisted coming up next here on the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Melissa Carter.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham.
No evidence supports the claim that privatizing the VA would bring veterans better care.
AFGE National Secretary Treasurer Joseph Flynn, the American Federation of Government Employees, wants to save the VA from privatization, the union says, with 49,000 unfilled positions at the Veterans Administration. Hiring more people to care for vets would be a far greater benefit to veterans than scheming to privatize the VA. At a recent summit to save the VA from privatization, Flynn said veterans don't want their health care privatized, and private health care systems aren't any better than the VA.
A recent American Legion study co-authored by Suzanne Gordon found that the VA health system performs as well as and often better than the rest of the U.S. healthcare system, and especially when it comes to patient safety, patient satisfaction, and care and coordination. And the study found that currently wait times are typically the same or shorter than those seeking private treatment. In other words, the VA is doing a better job than ever, and this is the time to strengthen the system further, not weaken it.
For WIN, I'm Joanne Powers. Editorial workers at alternative weekly The Chicago Reader announced Friday that they've unanimously approved a contract, ending a 2-year struggle with the paper's previous owners that culminated in a series of cutbacks and a strike authorization vote by workers in May. The first contract in the paper's 46-year history was reached after the Reader and sister paper The Chicago Sun-Times were acquired in July by an investment group that includes several labor unions affiliated with the Chicago Federation of Labor. The 1-year contract includes average pay increases of 8.4%, which the Chicago News Guild says will begin to correct long-standing pay inequities at the Reader, where salaries bore little relation to a person's job responsibilities or years of experience. Other key provisions of the contract include overtime pay and a ban on using freelancers to replace full-time staffers. Reader workers will also be entitled to improvements in retirement and health care if guild members at the Sun-Times editorial department win them in their next contract.
WIN is made possible in part by the OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. WIN is America's multimedia news voice for workers.
With OSHA that is going up against Menards, and then I also have a complaint with the NLRB because I brought up unions and I brought them up a couple times in communication with general management at the store. Former employees at Menards or maybe even current employees and just employees in general, if they find that their employer is doing this to them, speak up.
Support WIN's worker news mission at workersindependentnews.com. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
Try and get up every morning, day after day, and work for a living. Let's see him try that. Then we'll choose the real tough guy. The working man is a tough guy.
With me, Joe Wilson, a wealth management advisor. with a big money management house.
Mo money, mo money, yo money, Joe money.
We're happy to get the kind of money that jingles, but we'd rather get the kind that folds.
Not your grandpa's financial show.
What's going on, my money mavens and moolah misfits? It's me, your money guy, Joe Wilson of the Joe Knows Money Show, reporting live on Progressive Voices Network, delivering you 4 minutes of money news you can use. Trending this week in money news, according to the FAO Meat Price Index, global meat prices are up 10% from just a year ago. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, meat makes up 21% of the average American grocery budget, making it the most expensive category after processed foods. That leads me to my next topic, 4 ways to go mostly meatless. Number one, look to culture. There are several cultures that are entirely vegetarian, such as some Sikhs and Hindus. Many others use meat more as a garnish than a main course. Because these groups have been using vegetarian ingredients for generations, they figured out how to make their signature dishes as delicious and filling as any meat-based meal. Number two, spice it up. There's a reason they're so prominent in vegetarian recipes. Unlike a steak that tastes pretty great seasoned just with a little salt, a kidney bean needs a little bit more finesse. That isn't to say that vegetarian food is bland, but cooking vegetarian does require a bit of a shift in thinking. When you're cooking vegetarian, you need to think of your proteins as just one of the many ingredients that goes into the pot. Individually, none of them will knock your socks off. Together, they can be magic. Number three, ease into it. If you don't eat any vegetarian meals now, just reducing the amount of meat in your meals using vegetarian ingredients can be a great start. Also consider bacon as a substitute in many dishes. Just a couple of slices can make a big pot of mostly vegetarian corn chowder taste as rich and delicious as any meat-based meal. Plus, if you can learn to make a little bit of meat go a long way, it'll be good both for your budget and your body. Number four, get help. A vegetarian cookbook is great for those who don't know the first thing about building a meatless meal. Also, check out one of the many free popular recipe sites like Veggie Soul Food, allrecipes.com, and the Food Network. Now it's time for Joe's Money Trap of the Day. If you're going to try to eat a plant-based diet, there's one big trap to avoid in terms of cost: processed foods. Whole foods are always the way to go in terms of price. Eat a lot of beans and rice and you can survive on a few dollars a day. Veggie burger and tofu dogs? Not so much. In fact, processed vegetarian items are often a lot more expensive than their animal-based buddies in the meat aisle and have a ton of sodium. Here's Joe's money grab of the day. Disease costs a lot of money in terms of doctor's visits, procedures, surgeries, and medical devices. Keeping your heart healthy and your weight down through diet will help reduce the need for those medications and the monthly expenses that go along with them. Research has shown that plant-based and vegetarian diets are associated with lower rates of obesity, health disease, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and cancer. And now it's time for Joe's quote of the day. Do the best you can until you know better. Then when you know better, do better. That is a quote by Maya Angelou. You are listening to the Joe Knows Money Show on Progressive Voices Network. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/Joe Knows Money to hear this and other 4 minute money news you can use segments.
Whether you are in or out of town on New Year's Day, I invite you to watch the Rose Bowl Parade on January 1st. I have the honor as a kidney transplant recipient of riding on the Donate Life Float, thanks to my sponsor, Atlantis Piedmont Healthcare. Find out more and become an organ donor at DonateLifeFloat.org. That's DonateLifeFloat.org. Welcome back to She Persisted. I'm Melissa Carter. If you are a planner, well, if you're a real planner, you already have your holiday travel booked. But if you are planning a little bit ahead and you're thinking about Thanksgiving travel and Christmas travel and New Year's travel and even maybe winter 2018 travel, this applies to you. Now, the Business Insider has asked a bunch of airline workers to reveal industry secrets. So they have 6 tips for you to fly like a pro. And I want to share these with you now, especially if you have to fly to your destinations over the next few months. First, the best time to book your ticket is on Tuesday at 2:30 Eastern Time, 2:30 in the afternoon on a Tuesday. Now, that may seem very specific, but listen to this. Most tickets are bought on the weekend, so don't start getting antsy the next couple of days and buying your ticket, because they say it takes a day or so to process those tickets, and then the airline puts the leftover inventory on sale. So that's why by Tuesday, when they see what seats are left, they put a discount price on them. And so Tuesday, 2:30 p.m., Eastern Time, best time to book your ticket. Some more advice from airline experts. Hydrate, hydrate, hydrate. Airplane cabin air is less than 20% humidity. I didn't realize that, but that's even drier than the Sahara. The Sahara has 25% humidity, and airplanes have 20%. So you'll become dehydrated much faster in a dry environment, so they suggest to drink a bottle of water before you get on the flight. That is opposite of what I do. I'm the person who, I like to put my headphones on, I like to chill out, I zone out, and I don't want to have to get up and go to the bathroom during the flight. You know, excuse me if I'm not in the aisle, excuse me, and then get back there and then get, it just, in this little bathroom. However, and I tend to not drink before the flight in order to avoid that. But I'm wrong. These guys are right. So drink water before the flight. Now, here is an interesting tip, again, from the Business Insider. This is Secrets to Fly Like a Pro. Fly at odd hours if you want to avoid sitting next to a baby. Now, I'm a mom, and I sympathize when I see mothers of children, because you cannot predict how a child is going to handle a flight. However, I understand and sympathize also with the people that don't want to be bothered. The experts say most new parents will not fly at odd hours. I don't understand why that's so bizarre, but fly at odd hours to avoid sitting next to a baby. Another suggestion if you want to get a better seat. If you're on the plane and you see a seat that you'd rather have, they say to bring cash. And that way you might be able to pay the person in the seat you want to switch. I would never think of that. Well, I hardly ever carry cash anyway, which is bad, but I'm not the negotiator. I'm not the person that can haggle for something. I'm the worst at I'm such a sucker. Honestly, I'm such a sucker. But if you are good at that kind of thing, then take cash on the plane, and there may be somebody that'll take that cash and go a few aisles back. Airline workers say to sit at the back of the plane to get better service. They say if you sit closer to the flight attendant's area, which is in that back area, you've seen the coffee maker and the, you know, the refrigerators or the trays back there. Well, they say that they will be quicker to respond to you if you're sitting closer to them, obviously, because they don't have as far to walk. But it's also easier for them to slip you extra drinks if you're polite to them. Don't be discouraged if you're in the back row. Just be nice to the flight attendant and you might get an extra drink. And finally, the last tip from airline workers for the Business Insider, they say check in early to avoid being bumped from your flight. So some airlines bump those who checked in last, or they will bump whoever has the cheapest ticket. So if you are somebody who constantly gets bumped from your flight, you may just want to get to the airport early. So now you are a better flyer. You have more intelligence, more wisdom when it comes to flying. So good luck this holiday season. More She Persisted to come here on the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Melissa Carter.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders of The Laura Flanders Show. Catch a fresh episode every week on Free Speech TV, Link TV, and our own YouTube channel at lauraflanders.com. Here's this week's commentary, the F word. To target activists in the 1970s, U.S. intelligence agencies conducted so much illegal surveillance that they generated one of the biggest scandals in U.S. history. The abuses of the 70s led to the Watergate hearings, the Church Committee, and the creation of a permanent Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. 40 years on, a lot of people are watching documentaries about the Vietnam War, while our government conducts surveillance ops that put anything from that era to shame. The only thing Americans seem to be doing less now than then is protest. So why is that? Not long ago, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security quietly announced that it will be collecting more data on more people. Starting October 18th, alongside everything else they already track, the DHS will be gathering social media information, Twitter handles, Facebook accounts, Instagram pictures, search records, viewing history, calling history, you name it. DHS and its immigration unit ICE will be targeting immigrants, they say. But they actually include everyone not born a citizen and anyone who interacts with those people. So that scoops up me and I bet you, certainly everyone in the Trump administration who communicates with the First Lady. In the 1970s, the FBI and CIA said their targets were domestic terrorists and foreign radicals. What people discovered all too late is that they were actually going after civil rights leaders, feminists, journalists, not just Jane Fonda and Art Butwalt and Dr. Martin Luther King or Muhammad Ali, but everybody who interacted with those people. Back then, Democrats in Congress held hearings, gathered evidence, concluded that a long, shocking list of privacy rights had been violated. Among those, the right to assemble, the right to speak, the right to associate, the right to communicate. And they took action. As in the internet age, we do all these things online, we should at least be hearing a bit of hue and cry, especially from those who claim to abhor big government. In the 70s, enough people got angry, even in Congress, that they demanded tighter controls on intelligence gathering and more oversight. Today, we're hearing murmurs, mostly about the privacy rights of so-called legal immigrants and citizens. We should know better. If our predecessors had realized more clearly sooner that spying wasn't only someone else's problem, but actually theirs, we might not be here today. Surveillance isn't a problem only for them, but not us. In a free society, it's a problem for democracy. The Laura Flanders Show recently completed a series on digital security. Find out what you can do to secure your phone and your social networks now at lauraflanders.com. Write to me, tell me what you think. That's Laura, L-A-U-R-A, at lauraflanders.com. And subscribe to get another F word next week. The Laura Flanders Show is a TV and radio program that seeks to raise radical spirits by interviewing forward-thinking people with real experiences of shifting power from the few to the many. Join us.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History. Into.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1899. That was the day union miners in Mount Olive, Illinois, began commemorating Miners' Day. Every year, thousands came into town for a parade, music, and speeches. Mount Olive was the site of the only union-owned cemetery in the United States, established by UMWA Local 728 in the aftermath of the Verdun Massacre. A year before to the day, striking miners had been killed in a shootout with company goons attempting to herd scabs into the mines in Verdun, Illinois. But, as Mother Jones biographer Elliot Gorn notes, the train never unloaded its cargo and the company was forced to settle. The union hoped to erect a gravesite monument commemorating those miners who had been killed at Verdun, but they were refused by those who considered the fallen miners to be murderers and not martyrs. That's when the United Mine Workers established the Union Miners Cemetery. And on this day, 10,000 turned out for the union's memorial ceremony. The United Mine Workers unveiled a monument dedicated to the fallen Verdun miners E.W. Smith, Joe Gitterly, Ernest Kramer, and E.F. Long. The day was filled with parades, music, laying of wreaths, and speeches. Haymarket widow and radical activist Lucy Parsons was among the speakers. In his book, Death and Dying in the Working Class, Michael Rosnow notes that her presence drew a direct connection between the fallen miners and the Haymarket martyrs, cut down while advancing the cause of labor. Thousands traveled to Mount Olive every year for celebrations, including Eugene V. Debs, miners' leader John Mitchell, and Mother Jones. In 1923, Mother Jones asked to be buried with her boys, noting they are responsible for Illinois being the best organized labor state in America.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to She Persisted. I'm your host, Melissa Carter. If you are the mother of a four-legged furry child, I want you to listen to this cautionary tale, because it's not just you that dips into that cookie jar at the house. It could also be your dog. A British puppy had to be rescued by firefighters after the poor thing got his head stuck in, yeah, a cookie jar. His name is Buddy. He's a pug chihuahua mix. And apparently the cookie jar was empty, but there were still crumbs at the bottom. And he sniffed those crumbs and decided he wanted to try to lick those crumbs. So he pushed his head further and further into the jar until, sure enough, his head became wedged. Now, his owner said that he tried to slide Buddy's head out using dish soap, but couldn't get it done. And I guess he didn't want to break the jar because it was glass and didn't want to hurt the puppy, so he called firefighters. And they came out, and one of the animal rescue specialists, whose name is Anton Phillips, gently pushed and pulled the pup's loose skin. That's how he was able to wedge him out, and then he said there was a loud pop when his head finally came out. Phillips says it was an unusual job, and it was actually strange to see his expression through the glass as he was trying to save him. But he did. Buddy's okay. So just be sure and keep the cookie jar away from the dogs and the kids and sometimes yourself when it's the middle of the night and you've got that craving. If you see any of these stories, please share them with me. You can always catch me online, Twitter, at Melissa Carter, 1L, 2S's. On Facebook and Instagram, it's at Melissa Carter, ATL. I'd love to hear from you anytime. And also, anytime, if you miss any of the She Persisted shows, shame on you. You can always download them on demand 24/7 at the Progressive Voices app. So I'd love for you to go ahead and download that free app. You can also send us a message on the Progressive Voices app if you want to be part of the show. So we'd love it. Thank you for joining She Persisted today. I hope to see you again tomorrow, and I hope you have a fantastic day. Bye-bye.